think we'll get started, even though I think there may be some others that will trickle in. My name is Karen Blomquist, and this is the second session, especially focused on the verb seeing and how that might be a way of connecting with what not only what people of faith have long been about, but also what it means in our world today, and especially a world where illusions false promises are all pervasive. So what I'd like to do is to begin by having three people read the verses that I have up here. First John 1, verses 1, Luke 18, 42, and John 9, 25 and 29. These are three of the instances where seeing becomes very important in terms of what Jesus or the gospel are about. So does somebody want to read the First John?
We declare to you what was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have looked at and touched with our hands concerning the word of life.
Okay. How about the second one?
Luke 18, 42. And Jesus said unto him, receive thy sight, thy faith hath saved thee.
Okay, and that's after the healing of the man who was blind. At the end of that whole account in Luke. And the third, John 9, 25 and 29.
What's out of here? He answered, I do not know whether he's a sinner. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. 29. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from. Now, Jordan.
Maybe it should be, that was 29. I came so that those who do not see may see, and those who see become blind.
Is that 29? What verse is that?
It probably is 39.
Well, 39.
Yes.
Okay. So you want me?
Read it?
Yeah. Okay, Jesus said, it is 39, right? Jesus said, I came into this world for judgment, so that those who do not see may see, and those who do see may become blind.
Okay. Certainly we could point to a number of other passages where seeing becomes very, or something comparable to seeing becomes a very key word in what Jesus is communicating, certainly through the many parables and through many accounts where, and especially I think what becomes apparent is that again and again, Jesus is turning over or subverting what can be seen. He shifts people's perspectives. So I think the example of the healing of the blind man is a case in point where, somehow the man born blind is able to see in a way that those who see become blind. So he's constantly revealing and turning things over and having his followers look at things in a different way. I want to at least give you some sense of why I want to focus on seeing. Because the focus here is on a multifaceted kind of seeing that enables a kind of transcendence, a kind of presence of God to break through the structures and ideological mandates that might be reigning over ordinary people's lives. Through remembering, new visions or perspectives on social realities begin to emerge. This in turn necessitates and empowers change in all of the injustices in which people and the rest of creation are so often enmeshed. Seeing breaks in from beyond, both spatially and historically. and it shifts our horizons. What we can see moves us beyond closed systems that encapsulate us and usually are taken for granted. And I think seeing is what ordinary folks often do, and the rest of us just want to say, oh, let's quickly cloud over that. An example is something that was shared with me by a colleague who about 50 years ago was growing up here in Washington. He was, I think, the son of a pastor who took him to visit some of the Hispanic farm workers in that part of Washington, who literally were living in a horse barn, in horse stalls. And as a five-year-old, he was very, this young boy was very, you know, horrified by that. You know, I mean, and so the next day he went to school, and his teacher had been telling them how Abraham Lincoln had freed all the slaves from captivity. And he said, no, he didn't. I just saw people living in slavery yesterday. Mm-hmm. And the teacher said, no, you've got that wrong. That happened back then. That's not happening here in Washington today. And yet he could see with his eyes what was going on. Another example is about 9 years ago, when I was with the Lutheran World Federation, we had a climate change encounter in India off the Sea of Bengal. And basically these were villages of people who, you know, basically couldn't read or write necessarily. They certainly weren't Christian. But they embraced us widely and wanted to show us what in fact had happened to their land, because their village had literally been, you know, was literally some kilometers into the sea, and the rising sea, of course, had caused them to move, and all the signs of climate change that they could see with their eyes. They didn't have high education, but they knew quite well what was going on. I mean, they knew even the scientific statistics that are oftentimes in some of the media around here just shoved aside. But they knew quite well what was happening in their village. So I think seeing becomes a very important kind of move for uncovering the reality of what is going on in our world today. Seeing implies that what can be glimpsed through the senses, rather than what is mostly theoretical and abstract, is what matters. Seeing is empirical and incarnate. The common, the ordinary, what's experienced or sensed gains interest and significance theologically and from a faith perspective. God is known in the ordinary, in what is familiar, what is close at hand, every day. Contrary to popular views, seeing is not what individuals do on their own. We see as part of and in relationship to community. And that's why some of what we were talking in here yesterday about what we see depends who we affiliate with. Certainly it depends what TV stations we watch or what media organs we view. But seeing in community and seeing in a community that we might call church becomes really significant for seeing what is going on. And that's why I find interesting in so many congregations that there is an evoking of realities that we might not personally see, but that others see around the world. One of the things I did earlier this year is I asked to do the rewrite of the ecumenical prayer cycle of the World Council of Churches, which you can, if you just say ecumenical prayer cycle in the Google, you can Google it, and it brings to the fore certain realities around the world, certain countries that we don't even think about. For example, some of the countries in the former Soviet Union, whose names we probably can't even pronounce. But what are the issues? What are the realities? How do we give a face to the the kind of reality of what people there are struggling with. Whether or not they're Christian, that's not the issue. But where do we see God at work in the world? What we see and refuse to see and how we see are morally loaded, bearing upon whether we foster or thwart transformative change. False sight cripples moral agency when we are taught not to see certain things. Critical and morally responsible sight is necessary. Critical seeing burns us up unless it is also wedded to seeing in the same sense a second reality, the life-giving, life-saving, empowering of God that courses through all creation. A God whose love for this world cannot be thwarted by any force on earth or heaven. Seeing is also somewhat akin to what I was just, the passage from Dorothy Zola that I was reading. It's somewhat akin to mysticism. It is seeing God in all things and all things in God in a way that Sally McFaig insists is radically incarnational. In other words, is radically what God becoming Christ is all about. We see God in the face of Jesus. For it is the God who said, "Let light shine on the darkness." We talked a lot about light last night in the Vespers. Let light shine in the darkness. This God has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So we develop a double vision or a kind of bifocal vision, seeing at the same time everything as it is and everything in God. In other words, and that's what I think of theology of the cross, especially how we see things as they really are, not the pretense, not all of the hyped up kind of, but what is really going on. I would insert at this point, I think part of our discussion we talked about yesterday becomes very relevant because I think in many ways what we've been experiencing in recent months is that people who feel they haven't been seen or heard have been expressing outbursts, you know, and somehow that pain is coming to the fore. Now, I think it's been brewing for a long time, and I'm going to share with you in a minute or two a bit of how I've tried to analyze some of this some years ago. But I think now this is coming out, and we're saying, how do we give space for that to be heard and to listen to the pain that's behind all of that? Not that that becomes the end point, but that becomes the beginning of, I would say, transformation. And so the whole seeing, remembering, connecting process that I'm proposing is a process of transformation that I think is really running throughout Scripture, running throughout faith traditions, especially Jewish and Christian traditions. And therefore, it is not something that is new.
Could you read the sentence again about being taught not to see? In the congregation, or being taught not to see. Didn't you have a sentence about that?
Based on the community that you're with, is that what you mean?
Yeah. In other words, a community. Well, I'm not sure. I was kind of spontaneously saying that, but
it was when you were reading,
right? But the community we see as part of and in relationship to community. The assumptions, values, and worldviews of such affect what we see and what we focus on or ignore.
Yeah. And that's what we're comfortable with.
Yeah. But I think that's why being nurtured in the long term in a faith community becomes so important. Because we're able, you know, we're helped through Scripture and et cetera to see differently. So it's the same realities that others might see, but somehow we're able to see that with a double vision, to see what's going on, but also to see that somehow God is active in and in among that. Not in ways that we necessarily, you know, shot from the mountaintop most of the time, but at least we can see.
Well, as you were talking about that, I was thinking about, I mean, you were talking about the people who feel unseen and are now really, you know, making themselves seen and heard. But I think in the same way, you know, decision makers in Washington, D.C. are a community too. And their sight is limited by the community that they associate with. You know, and so they don't see the pain of other people. It's easier to just have your community's ideology.
And then you were also saying that we should listen to these people and their pain and understand it. But what if it's unrealistic? Like the coal miners. Well, and the promises they're given.
Let me move further into this, because I think in part it's how the illusion can begin to be peeled away, because you're right. I mean, to say there's been a nostalgia of, oh yeah, going back 50 years when coal was king, which, you know, it increasingly isn't today. So, you know, on the one hand, you and I might agree saying that's unrealistic, but how do we listen to the pain and then provide the alternative interpretations? In other words, people being hit over the head from the top down with somebody telling them that is probably not going to be very effective. But how do we, through relationship and transformative relationship, how does that begin to move? I'm going to jump a little bit out of order here and refer to what I think I've done something about this at Holden in the past. Individual.
UA.
Individual, well.
UA.
UA. I'm too close to it. Privatization. I can't spell this one. 30 years ago, when I was especially focusing theologically to understand what was going on with working class folks, I realized there was a kind of ideology or a kind of reigning power over people's lives. Now, I think this applies to many of us in American society, so I don't want to just pinpoint working class folks. But the degree to which everything is related to the individualism, what I can do, will I succeed as an individual, and all the kinds of American dream stuff that plays that out. And then if I don't succeed, who can I blame? The victimization, you know, it's you know, I've been, you know, the factory is closed, the coal mine is closed, the copper mine is closed, whatever. Rather than this leading to the wider systemic analysis of saying, why is that? And how to make connection with other things. More often than not, it's falling back into a kind of privatization. Well, I'll at least cocoon myself in my family and, you know, damn the rest of the world. Because, you know, at least I will try and make it, even though it becomes an endless cycle of, and I think for many people in this society, it's become a kind of endless cycle of feeding back into itself. And so what we've experienced in recent months is some of that is exploding out into the public, into the political arena, and rest of us are saying, oh, why haven't we seen this all along? Now, a part of what I think is operating is the power of illusion and people giving into illusion. I want to read a passage that I found particularly helpful. Sometimes secular analyses can help us to see things. This particular description of illusions by Chris Hedges, actually he went to theological, I think he went to Yale Divinity School and then became a journalist and he's done all kinds of things. But this was written a few years ago. In other words, it was written in a pre-2016 or 2017 kind of era. And but see if he was being a little bit predictive of what has broken out. We live in virtual worlds created by those who profit from deception. A public that can no longer distinguish truth from fiction. We've had a lot of that. Truth is what I believe, and don't bother me with the facts. A public that can no longer distinguish truth from fiction is left to interpret reality through illusion. The worse reality becomes, the more people seek refuge and comfort in illusions. For example, in your case, that coal will somehow come back. Lies and distortions become truth, and people can believe what they want to. Blind faith in illusions is our culture's secular version of being born again. Blind faith in illusions is our culture's secular version of being born again. Any reactions to that?
I'd like a copy of that.
You can have this. I'll grab these papers.
I'm reading a book, and maybe I can bring it sometime. It's a collection of writings from different people in Minnesota, but really it could apply to any state or the whole country, where they're taking different cultural people from different cultural backgrounds, Hmong, Hispanic, Nigerian, what else? Somali. And basically each writer gives voice to their racial experience. Mm-hmm. And I'm really learning just recently how even the word race is a white constructed word. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm really trying to, there's a group at our church that's delving into race relations and, mm-hmm. and issues. And one of the writers who is Japanese heritage writes so poignantly about his parents being interned, and there was an internment camp actually in southern Minnesota, believe it or not. Most of the press is about here in Washington, but what he says pretty poignantly is that if my parents came and then I was born here. And the fact that they the whole issue of who has claim to this country, mm-hmm. and if obviously the African American can't make that claim, Japanese can't make that claim, but then he says the Native Americans aren't even allowed to have that claim.
Yeah.
So how in the world can anybody coming here, if even our native people can have the claim to be our native people, mm-hmm. how complex is that? And it's just, I just read that yesterday and I've been just steeped in how hard it is to, break up those layers of, mm-hmm. Entitlement and privilege and, the folks who say go back home,
yeah.
that are white and immigrant.
Right.
So there's a lot of stuff, and our church is actually, well, the Twin Cities has really gotten involved in the sanctuary movement, mm-hmm. And it's been remarkable. I think we're our church is now Sanctuary Church, and mm-hmm. there are now 32 churches in the Twin Cities now that have, you know, taken a deep breath and said, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of unknowns as to what this means. But Jesus calls to, you know, to call the, you know, meet the stranger where they are, where they're at. And I think that's so much of what our culture is based on, fear. Fear, fear, everywhere.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
When I think once we begin to see, we cannot do otherwise.
Exactly. Right, exactly.
And because, you know, it becomes... And I think this is where we talked yesterday a little bit about the competing versions of Christianity, but I think it's also competing versions of how we how people see.
Exactly.
And which is why I want to indicate that I think for those who might not feel that we do or interpret that we do, and I'm not assuming everyone here is on the same wavelength that way, mm-hmm. but at the same time, they're our way of seeing and their way of seeing, you know, they're quite different, but seeing is the same. And how do we start conversations with those who see things differently?
Right, exactly.
And starting at that point, rather than say, oh yeah, you're wrong. And your examples are very very helpful, because I think it's as congregations take the first step, mm-hmm. which is why even the feeding of the homeless or whatever we could say, you know, a lot of social activists can say, well, that doesn't affect the big picture, but it can be a step of helping us see and therefore act and deal mm-hmm. with the more systemic issues that are generating that. Mm-hmm. That's why it was kind of amazing. I read, and I'll read at the end from something from Dorothy Zola, and she had come to my home congregation in Brooklyn, or the congregation where I was serving there, for a Lenten series, and we were reading. Oh, it was just a one-page kind of thing. It was during the war, one of the Central American wars, and what was happening in terms of the oppression going on there. And all of a sudden, it was like the floodgates broke, and one of the members said, I know what it's like to have somebody stepping on my neck. You know, and he had described a lot of his, you know, work as a worker in New York City. Mm-hmm. And in this pretty apolitical congregation, it was kind of amazing, and Dorothy and I kind of sat there and couldn't quite believe what was going on. They were ready to start a campaign to impeach the Secretary of State. I think it was Haig at that point. And the next year I came back just to visit, and they had become the site in New York City for the commemoration of Archbishop Romero's assassination. Mm-hmm. In other words, this was a congregation that you know, all of a sudden they began to see and they began to connect. And that's why it's hard for me to take apart the seeing, remembering, and connecting, because I think they came together in the story that you were sharing. But all of a sudden that becomes motivating. Mm-hmm. But it means seeing and inviting people to see with us, or somehow listening to what others are seeing that we aren't seeing.
The storytelling is so key.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And somehow the stories become that point of contact, and therefore the point of transformation in the long term, but not overnight.
Right.
Which is why I think that community of trust, whether it's a congregation or other, what, you know, over the long term, it's not just a kind of fly by night kind of thing, but something that's in there for the long haul.
Because you also have to have the person. The storytelling is great if they're willing to listen, but you have a lot of people that, you know, aren't willing to listen because they feel their side or their story is the truth.
Right.
And
right.
So you've got to have seek those people that are willing to listen and also to speak.
But then even the hard cases of why. Are they where they put up the walls? I mean, you know, obviously you may not be the person in the to really plunge into with on that, but at the same time to try to say, even the most hardened people, mm-hmm. you know, what's going on, and you know, not that you want to go all over there.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Oh, over here, I think. It's hard for me to see over here, especially with the light.
Well, I'm thinking of the coal miners, and we lived in D.C. from 71 to 74, and at that time, they were building the subway in D.C., mm-hmm. and there were signs on the, in Appalachia, there were signs in the cafe bulletin board that said, "We will consolidate your debts. We will pay for moving costs. We will do all these things. Just come and help us build the subway." Oh, so it was jobs. It was a package deal. It would take care of everything. And family meant more than money.
Job.
Period. And they'd eat squirrel and do what they had to do to stay put. Mm-hmm. And those jobs absolutely went back in.
And a tie to the land, I think.
The what?
A tie to the land.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you look at some of this value stuff. Mm-hmm. The values are with the land and the people mm-hmm. and family, mm-hmm. not with almighty dollar.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's really interesting, because how do I know that I'm not the person who's not listening? I think one of the complaints, there's the elitist left that we think we know all the answers, and that's true for me. I don't know if it's true for everybody, but so if there are ways for me to listen, if I could learn to listen more to people who have a different viewpoint, I think that would be very helpful, because if land is the value in home, and well, that's important to me too, and maybe there's a way to bridge things, maybe there's a way to have a different industry and let people make their livings where they are now. And I can admire that value, like polluting the planet. I think, why would they want to pollute the planet? But if they want to stay in their home, that makes sense to me. I can see them a different way that way. Mm-hmm. So thank you for sharing.
But look at when we had the Spotted Owl incident and they closed down all the forestry industry, and those people they were forced. I mean, they wanted to stay where they were. They were forced to go to school to learn a different trade, but then there was no trade. You know, they couldn't implement that in their communities, so they were forced really in the long term to have to relocate so that they could make the money. So it's not always possible to live off the land and the squirrel and the, you know, whatever, because of the way things are changing.
I'm going back to the Bible verse that one of you read, which I'm going to horribly paraphrase, but Jesus said, "I have come so that the blind can see, and those who can see become blind." I think of that as a circle. Wherever we start in the world, we don't see clearly.
Exactly.
And I think for those of us who are white and middle class by, you know, birth or opportunity, it's very, very difficult to see clearly. I think it's unusually difficult for us to see clearly. And we need to become blind. And one way that I think of that is we need to know that how little we know. And so when we talk about communities that we haven't lived in or haven't lived in, I grew up as a migrant kid, but I'm a lawyer now. I mean, I haven't lived in that community for 50 years, more than that. So I don't know very much about that community of people. And I think of the blindness as we hear first. We don't tell, we don't sit down to explain. We say, "We know nothing about you." And we hear first, and then over time, we see. But I think part of seeing as you go through that cycle is realizing that we'll never see as clearly as we thought we did when we thought we knew.
Yeah.
because even what you were saying about the 1970s, I mean, later that happened with, you know, Detroit, a lot of people did go, and then those jobs dried up, and then there they were, stuck in, you know, Michigan or Ohio or wherever they went. And still, when those jobs dried up, they had those Appalachia families had no place to go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that land is folded up. The road up from Lucerne is a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's got wide turns and that sort. These roads were just like this, and it went 15 miles an hour. And transportation alone was a huge issue. You know, the land and the way it's all set up does not lend itself to Google or Nike or, you know, any of these places. It just doesn't.
Yeah.
And I can see the illusion of saying we can go, it doesn't say go back, but we can have jobs right here in coal, that would be very attractive.
Sure.
And whoever's going to make those promises gets elected, right?
Yeah.
Ooh. Let me bring in something that I think how this connects with seeing God, and this is from Sally McVeigh. We do not see the face of God directly, but we meet God in the face of Jesus. In Jesus eating with outcasts, healing the sick, destabilizing the wealthy and powerful, welcoming the stranger, siding with the oppressed, and inviting everyone to the table. This is the glory of God that we see in the face of Jesus, and we see that a different world is possible. And I would say that seeing that a different world is possible is what's key here, because I was reading yesterday, Walter Brueggemann, you know, basically saying that if we only talk about seeing Jesus, but it's seeing Jesus as a way into a different world is possible, which again and again is what Jesus was leading his disciples into. And they didn't get most of the time, and we don't get most of the time, mm-hmm. but that becomes really key.
Yeah, like how the psalmist sings, and I don't think about it enough. Sing to the Lord a new song, and how, what does that really mean? You know, that we get our favorite hymns and such, but then if, you know, to kind of even move within our worship services to a different kind of worshiping experience, but then take that out into society and culture and sing a new song and how we are as a culture and people. It's pretty profound, I think.
Well, and as I was saying, I can't remember if I said this week or last week, but John Hall says, the importance is gospel is not a fixed code, but it is news that it becomes good in relationship to a given situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so often, you know, gospel becomes just encoded something, and then how it connects with what in fact people are experiencing or seeing around them,
mm-hmm.
Is it often stops short. To move on, imminent critique of life begins to emerge as people confront the promise with the reality. What is theoretically promised is critiqued on the basis of what we are actually experiencing and seeing in our lives and communities. And which is why I think a lot of people who voted as they did in the last election are beginning to say, oh, now we realize maybe our health care might disappear, or we aren't getting the jobs, or we aren't getting this or that. And people.
I think they put their blinders on still. I really do.
Yeah.
I don't think they're seeing
because
at
the
all.
Power, the power of the illusion and the promise is powerful.
Yeah, it's still there.
And therefore, it's going to, I think, take a while. But at the same time, I think this is where, as people of faith, the kind of long-term, how do we see differently in the world? I think hanging in there, listening to what is being said is important. In the midst of that. What time are we?
2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. Let me conclude. I began over there with something from Dorothy Zola. And this from her book, Window of Vulnerability. This is in the library, actually. She has an article on, it relates a little bit to what we were talking about yesterday. And she calls it, with a jarring term, Christofascism. Now, she is someone who was born, you know, in 29 in Germany. So she, you know, her life was really one of fighting against fascism. And she became very suspicious, teaching for many years in this country, of how certain forces were engaged in a kind of Christofascism in terms of how they used Christ to really reinforce the kind of agenda that we're talking about. At a mass meeting, 1,000 voices shouted, "I love Jesus and I love America," but it was impossible to distinguish the two. This kind of religion knows the cross only as a magical symbol of what he has done for us, not as a sign that the poor man was tortured to death as a political criminal, like thousands today who stand up for truth. This is a God without justice, a Jesus without a cross, an Easter without a cross. What remains is a metaphysical Easter bunny in front of the beautiful blue light of the television screen, a betrayal of the disappointed, a miracle weapon in service of the mighty, whoever that mighty is. I would hate to see what, well, unfortunately she's not alive today, but if she had, I think she would have plenty to say about U.S. in 2017. Some rather sharp words. So thank you for coming. Have a good day of work, and we'll see you around the village.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I have...